Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCPN
106.5
FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. And of course, I'm Al Warren, and Mr. David North Martino is here.
Yeah. All three names.
Yeah.
Again.
All
is this,
excited.
Is this another week where you're going to be
No.
Be nice?
No, it's going to be one of those you don't see it coming.
Oh, okay. That's good. Makes it more exciting.
Makes it much more exciting.
Right.
You know, I'm going to pull a Vin Diesel on you.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
I'm walking off the set.
Yeah, I can't work.
That's it.
I can't work. I can't work with him. You know, anyway. Stop bugging Vin. He's my buddy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, speaking of Vin Diesel, we've got a real action star here today. So we're going to talk to a man that's not only living it, but writing about it. So, Mr. Jack Leavers, thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you. It's thank you for inviting me, Alan.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Wow. So you have quite the life. So a Royal Marine for over 30 years. You're in private.
Yeah, I mean, I was a Royal Marine for 9 years. So it's 30 years of military and private security experience. So in fact, the private security experience now is far surpasses the time that I spent in the Corps.
Why would someone leave the Royal Marine and go into private security? Like, is it just better money or a better position? What makes a person do that?
Money. Well, you know what it's like with the military. The guys in the military, certainly the way it was when I was there in the 80s and 90s, are always talking about what they're going to do next. There's always this grass is always greener kind of feel. And of course, most of the time, you know, you're actually, when you're in the military, it's probably the times you're always going to look back on as the best times. But you always believe there's something amazing around the corner, and you're always hearing rumors of that big contract that's out there. It's just sort of sometimes some of the guys, the best guys in the military actually leave. I mean, a lot of them stay, but sometimes they leave because they don't quite fit into the sort of regimen of the military so well. You know, a bit more free thinking, and a bit more entrepreneurial, and that they get out and, you know, they get involved in, well, especially what's happened since, certainly since 2001, since 9/11, you know, the whole world changed private security wise, and there's a lot of opportunities out there. Well, there certainly were during that first decade.
Is it quite a bit different, the two types of service? Like when you're in the military itself, there's one way of living and working, behaving, so to speak, and you go to the private security. Is it a better lifestyle?
it's just, it's very, it is very different. I mean, you've got a, certainly in Iraq, we worked on Department of Defense contracts. So for Department of Defense, Department of State. So you're quite, you know, constrained by rules and regulations, but fundamentally the companies are much smaller entities, of course, than the military. When you're part of the big green machine, it's, you know, you're a very small cog in a huge, you know, organization. Whereas in a private security company, often, I've tended to work with smaller companies, you actually have a huge influence. I mean, whether you're the country manager or you're in a senior position or even a team leader out on the ground, you know, these are guys that are former NCOs rather than officers usually. So they've got command positions that they wouldn't really have in the same way in the military.
So when we see these movies on Netflix and places like that, and they're kind of based on private security action going all over, you know, Africa and Europe and different places, do they get that pretty accurate in the most part?
I think there's sort of two different types of sort of private security. There's the big government contracts, and when you get some of the, especially on the big American government contracts, I know you've got companies working down in South America and working all across out in the out in the Far East as well. And now that's at a different level to where I've been working. That's a far more organized. You know, you'll see some of the and mixed with OGA and, you know, and three data agencies and much closer to the government. That's certainly how it appears, from my experience. Whereas, and as I was saying, in Iraq, that was quite organized and you had various sizes of companies that, you know, all sitting there in that space. You go out to Africa and suddenly it's the Wild West. I mean, you're on your own. And I found even the same in Afghanistan for me personally. I didn't have much experience over there, but you don't have the same level of support and integration with officialdom. I mean, certainly in Africa, you're riding, you know, shotgun around the country, really, and making up, you know, liaising yourself and working off of your own initiative to try and get things done, and obviously to try and mitigate risk. Now, as far as the movies, I think a lot of the Netflix and the movies, they do get some of the things right, from what I can tell. But I certainly, when I decided to write a couple of books, I went down the very realistic route, as in I felt that it hadn't quite been shown the way that I understood it, which was small company, very very bespoke projects. You know, that are then, you know, big financial rewards, high risk, high reward. You know, there are some of these things. A lot of these things don't happen. A lot of these things never get the green light. But then some of them, when they do, that's when it gets quite interesting. And there are a lot of those projects probably gone that I certainly would know nothing about. So I'm sure that a lot of things that we see in the movies and on Netflix probably a bit tamer than what's actually happened for real. Because, you know, the truth is obviously usually far more unbelievable than fiction.
Well, when you're writing about private security, just like some military writers have to do, do you have to, I guess, submit your books for review to whether it be government or to the private security company that you're working for, to have it reviewed to make sure that you're not giving out confidential information, or does it not work like that?
Might do. I didn't. I mean, I didn't work for companies that are big enough, and I don't still work for any companies that would be affected. So for the last, for most of the last 20 years, I mean, I've been working for very small outfits or working for myself in a consultancy level. So it doesn't really apply. Okay. You know, and I've not been working closely with American, you know, government agencies or British government agencies. So there's no, you know, the confidentiality contracts that I did have to sign when I was in the military don't apply either, because I have actually worked for an American. I was a VP for an American company as well out in Iraq. So I've sort of worked the British and the American angle for American Department of Defense, Department of State. But those pieces aren't actually, I haven't written about any of that anyway. I mean, I actually, when my first book was set before I did that, before I actually worked on the, in the coalition side, if you like, before I worked behind the wire. And then the other book is way out there. It's well away from any officialdom.
What made you go into writing books and about things that you're a part of? Like, what was the catalyst for that?
In 2017, I'd done some work in Yemen. I'd been in Africa. We got caught up with the Ebola thing, so a bit of a problem. I'd done some work in Yemen, and that was a difficult situation over there. I'd done some work with the Peshmerga. I'd after ISIS, after Daesh rolled into the north of Iraq. Then I'd run a security company over in northern Iraq for a year. And then I got involved in United Nations contracting, as in providing generators, water, pipes, all kinds of things through the UN into northern and southern Iraq, you know, in the reconstruction after Daesh. And I got a bit burnt by a couple of those contracts, and I was waiting for money, and I was basically filled with bitterness and rage about what was happening. And I had to find a vent. I had to find something to put that energy into. And so I thought, well, you know, let me revisit this idea of perhaps writing a book. And that's literally how I did. I just sat down and thought, right, let's just start writing what happened. I knew the start point already because I'd always vowed that's where I'd start a book. And I just started writing. And then I wound a fictional plot into what really happened. And that was the first book. It took me about 3 or 4 months to get the first draft out. So I didn't have any long desire to write. In fact, I didn't even think it would be possible. I've been told I'm quite a good author of reports, of factual reports, of situation reports, of, you know, ground truth reporting from countries. In fact, I probably did my sort of writing apprenticeship actually working as an investigator between about 2000 and 2003, where I had a lead investigator, an intellectual property anti-counterfeiting, who vetted my reports, who edited them, who critiqued them. And there were some very I developed my own style in that. And actually those 3 years was probably where I developed the ability to put some words together. But it was all very much caveated because, it's when you're writing investigative reports, it's very different from writing fiction. But that's where that came from. And that's where the idea that I might be able to do it came from. But I never thought I didn't have a clue how you would go about writing a novel. I just sat down and started writing.
Well, that's like a lot of people. That's a, you know. So now your first book, that was Appetite for Risk.
Yep.
And now that's set after Saddam Hussein is fallen already, I guess, and they're on the rebuild. And now your main character, I guess, is Royal Marine John Pierce.
Yeah.
And he decides to take the opportunity to go to the country when it's rebuilding and perhaps make some money. So let's talk about this idea and also about John Pierce. Like, who is John Pierce and where do you get a character like that from? Someone you worked with there, or is it just kind of a combination, or is it you?
Basically John Pierce was me. I mean, it was actually an alias that I used in a cover company alias. I used an investigation company. And when I started writing, I just started writing what happened. And I think for all of us, when you go back, especially when you're talking about going back 15 years or longer, even your own memories actually become fictionalized, really. You don't really, I mean, I certainly don't truly actually remember. I mean, it's almost like trying to recall a movie that you've seen anyway. So I put myself back in the position. I've got photographs from the time, and I knew what had happened, and I just started writing the story. Now, I didn't have enough, it wasn't interesting enough. In fact, it was too complicated to try and do any kind of memoir, to try and do any kind of nonfiction. So the idea was to start writing and then just, you know, wind some fiction into it and try and get a cutoff point in the real story where it could, you know, where it would be a convenient point and a satisfying point to end the novel.
Oh, so you get lots of girls for John Pierce.
Yeah. I mean, well, now the thing is, of course, now what the problem with writing sort of, and with a character that's based on yourself, is that it becomes very difficult. Where I had the problem, it wasn't really my intention to do that, but the problem was that the point I started from was always going to be, and the moment I decided to write a book was when I was sat in the back of a black Mercedes on a road outside of the British base in Basra Airport, and the Iraqis in the car turned to me and said, "Are you a spy for the Israelis?" Now, the moment they did that, at the end of that day, I thought, if ever I write a book, that will be my opening line. Now, in fact, it didn't end up being the opening line, but that is the opening scene in Appetite for Risk. So I always had a place in my head that I thought I'd start writing a book from. The problem is when you've made a bit of pretty crazy decision to jump in a taxi in Amman and drive to Baghdad in February 2004, it's a bit difficult to try and find a fictional reason why anybody would do that. So I found myself having to use what really happened and the logic or the bootneck logic of why I came to that decision. So the more you add in real logic and real decision-making, what really happened, the more you have to keep adding that because to keep the whole story coherent and together. The trick was to wind in the fictional side of it. So in fact, the family side and everything else, a lot of that is, you know, is very, very close to the truth. I mean, in fact, Appetite for Risk is almost, I mean, it's a fictionalized snapshot of our family life for a couple of years.
So that's pretty exposing in a sense. Like when you put a lot of yourself and your family into something, that in itself has its own type of courage, right? Because you're kind of letting especially nowadays, because anybody in the world now can pick up your book and they can pretty much contact you or find you on the internet nowadays with social media and stuff. So do you ever worry about that a little bit because you kind of give your own sort of life out here?
To be honest, the feedback that I tend to get for that book is I remember another author telling me, no, you can't use that as a reason why the guy goes to Iraq. That doesn't make any sense. And I let him carry on. I said, but that was how it happened for real. I couldn't think of another reason why you would jump in a taxi on your own and, you know, with a guy that hardly speaks any English and go to Baghdad. And to be honest, it's so long ago. And I actually now think of the whole story. I almost can't remember, you know, it's difficult sometimes to remember which bits are fiction and which bits were real because I spent so much time with the book. I look at it more as John's story, not mine. And it's so long ago that there's nothing really that particularly controversial. And, you know, and certainly not in the bits that are close to what, you know, actual real life, real events. You know, the fictionalized stuff doesn't matter because it was fiction. And ultimately it's fiction. So even though, there may be a lot of me in there, and what happened, I fictionalized enough of it that it does make it fiction. It makes it John Pierce's story and not mine.
Did you discover something about yourself? Like when you're writing this part, like especially, okay, you do the first book, it's out there and you say you kind of weaved it around real events and it's like remembering a movie. So there's bits and pieces here and there and you've fictionalized it. But I wonder what at the end of the book, and when you're finished it, and now that it's out, do you sort of realize some things about yourself and about the time you were there writing about this that you didn't at the time? Did you learn something?
I think the biggest thing I took out of it, there were two things. One was how the surprise of how pleased I was to have done it. With regard to things like my dog at the time, who's long gone now, but Taz, you know, alive again in the book. Another thing was that I just had a feeling that it made that period so much more worthwhile than instead of it just being me, you know, sitting in the pub, throwing a few dits around to sort of old oppos. You know, I actually got some use out of some of those crazy times. You know, getting it into a book. I mean, it was almost like, oh well, that was at least that was some research for a book. But as far as sort of analyzing sort of what I got out of it, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's difficult because it just seems such a stupid thing to have done. I can't really explain it any other way, because I was literally sitting in a taxi. You know, you hear these people, you know, say this, and these characters say this in books. I was sitting in a taxi. We'd arrived at the border, at the Iraqi border. I was the only, you know, Westerner there. They probably thought I had a 4x4 outside the security team. It was just me and Thamer in the taxi, and I was on my way into Baghdad, and I just thought, what the hell am I doing? But you know, I was there, and I just sort of it was just like on autopilot. It's almost like you've sort of double dog dared yourself to do something, and you know, you've been talking about it for so long. Well, you know, you need to get up there and do it then. And it's like I say, and this is why I couldn't really use any other logic in the book other than how it really was, because I couldn't think of any other reason why someone would do it that really made sense.
Well, did you use a lot of the equipment and weaponry and stuff like that is used in those situations, like in a techno thriller within this book?
No, I mean, largely at the time, of course, we had mobile phones. We're in by 2004. You know, I had a mobile phone. We had internet just about. I did borrow bits of kit from former military guys. I mean, some of the tracking, the piece of tracking equipment in Bajor, that was a true story. you know, the sitting in the garden of the Palestine Hotel with my BGAN pointing at the satellites, again, that was another, you know, that was another borrowed piece of kit. So, you know, I did use those. So I didn't include anything that I hadn't personally experienced. But there was quite a, you know, that 2004, 2005 time was really before you get to the level of, and also the subject matter here was really, didn't really impinge onto that sort of high technical, you know, techno thriller sort of technical side of things. I steered away from the stuff I don't know anything about.
When you wrote this book, the first one, were you thinking about some sort of point that you wanted people to get? Did you want them to get something out of the book other than the action, adventure, and entertainment?
I wouldn't say I wanted them to get it, but I think what it does illustrate, I think it's a real walk through Iraq. I mean, in north, south, and center, with the people, you know, with Iraqis, you know, at the time, it actually I experienced, you know, from Baghdad and then down in Basra and then up into Kurdistan, you know, those local nationals, the Iraqis that I talked about, I mean, they were real people. There were real meetings. The general in Baghdad, you know, these people that believed he was going to be called up to the MOD, you know, these people were all real. I mean, these conversations all happened. So it was really, you know, the sort of thing that most people were on the other side. You know, they were inside the camps, they were inside the wire, and you know, we were out. Everything else was the red zone, and I was sort of out just buzzing around with my friends, with the locals. And you know, I think that picture is quite relatively unique. Now, I also know how ridiculous it seems, and how, you know, what happened to some other people that were doing similar to what I was, and they were captured, and you know, the worst things happened to them. So, and it did get scary. I mean, I think the more times you get away with something, you know, you go out there once, you're fine. You go out there twice, you're now on your 10th day. And you're going out and you're doing the same thing, and there's you're channeled through certain entrances, exits, so you're sure there'll be surveillance, and you know, you've got no real security around you, and you start realizing you're taking a hell of a risk, and actually you start getting, the more you get away with it, the more scared you get that you're really, you know, running your chances.
What do you think that we get wrong in the public about Iraq, like, do you know, about the people and the way they live and about what goes on there?
I'm not sure. I think that the chief thing, I mean, I don't know the South so well. And I know the North. I still work in the North. In fact, I might be back into Kurdistan next week. I was there last month. I still see some of the people actually that were in the first book. The chief thing I always found between Iraq and Afghanistan was in Iraq, the people want the same thing that we do. They want a nice school for their kids. They want to go on holiday, but sometimes, you know, within the country, often up into Kurdistan for the summer, where it's a bit cooler. They want a good school. They want to go out, you know, walking on into the cafes by the Tigris in the evenings. I mean, that was, you know, they want the same as we do, you know, in the West. I mean, it's a very recognizable society. And of course, religion wasn't a big thing under Saddam. In fact, he obviously suppressed it for a long time until after the 91 Gulf War, when he tried to embrace it to, you know, to rally support within the country. Whereas in Afghanistan, I think a lot of the people want to be left alone to do the things their way and don't really, you know, I'm talking outside of Kabul, you know, and so you've got an almost impossible, you had an almost impossible problem where you were trying to force what you believe is better for a lot of the population that they don't necessarily want. But I didn't really know Afghanistan so well. So, I mean, that's not really my fiefdom. I know some people that actually far preferred, you know, Afghanistan. I had a good friend of mine, and he couldn't stand Iraq, and his everything that he was doing was in Afghanistan. But for me, now with the Kurds, I mean, they are, you know, they are Western friendly. I mean, not just Western friendly. I mean, they're genuinely allies, really, for us. I mean, I'm talking about the Iraqi Kurds. Obviously, there are Syrian Kurds, Turkish Kurds, Iranian Kurds. It's that's got its own huge problems geopolitically. But certainly in northern Iraq, I've always felt amongst friends. In fact, it's probably the place that puts the biggest smile on my face is when I fly into Sulaymaniyah. I mean, it's like where I live, except safer. So it's like where I live south of London, except safer, and I've got more security around me and with better weather.
Yeah, less rain. Yeah. Yeah. Wow, that's crazy. Now you went on, and now you've got a new book that just come out, I believe. It's just out now. And it's called Don't Play Dead with the Vultures. If you've got it to go hard. That's my saying. Go hard. So this is 4 years later this happens. And what was kind of the progress? You decided that you would bring back your Marine John Pierce, and you're going to go into a new situation. How did that come about?
Well, funnily enough, I was in Iraq running convoys in 2007. No, sorry, in summer 2008. And I did get lured into Africa. So the sort of spine of the story, if you like, I think that the Don't Play Dead with Vultures is far more of it's fictional flesh on a skeleton of real events, real life. Especially with the timelines. So I was in the places doing some of the things that are in the book, but a lot of the scenes that may have occurred for real in some context aren't in the context and with the characters as that are described in the book. In Appetite for Risk, nearly all or most of the characters, probably 2/3 of Appetite for Risk happen for real. In Don't Play Dead with Vultures, it's far, far more fictionalized. I realized very early on that I had to fictionalize all the characters. Appetite for Risk was a guy going out although there were a lot of other characters around, a lot of them are ancillary characters that don't really, you know, they help him to move here, move there, get. In Don't Play Dead with Vultures, there were going to be far more characters that had a meaningful input that were important characters in the story, and I couldn't use real people for that. It narrowed what I could do with them, because I mean straight away I realized that I couldn't use guys that I'd worked in the company with on the convoys, because immediately I could only think of them and what they would say or what they had said, and I couldn't move outside of that. So I had to fictionalize it. And the moment I fictionalized all the characters, and there are also some characters actually that are literally too unbelievable for fiction that were involved for real. So that I knew were just ridiculous. I couldn't put them in. So once I'd fictionalized nearly everybody else around John Pierce, then I could use that framework of try and keep that visceral sort of reality, sitting someone in the car alongside the main character, alongside the characters. But completely fictionalize it, you know,
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes. Without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
These real life incidents happening, but in different contexts with different people at different times than how they happen for real. So it has this thread of real life that drives the story forward, and is the reason why it's such a long book. Actually, it's far longer than I intended, but it gives it again. It keeps it coherent. It gives it depth. And that's how I feel. And my intention was always to sit the character alongside John Pierce and, right, this is how it works. This is what it's like to be in these places doing these things.
Well, as you began, fictionalizing these characters and writing, how did you experience your characters? Could you hear them? Could you hear their voices? Was it more like a movie in your head? How does that work for you?
To be honest, when I was writing, especially this with Don't Play Dead with Vultures, it took me it was far longer time to write it. And I really sort of lived inside it, in the book. I mean, as in, it was almost like exactly the same as when I'm reading a book, when you're so engaged, you know, the sort of book that you just want to get back to and start reading it again. You're writing amongst it. And I was experiencing that, but as the author, that's how I felt. So I wouldn't say I was hearing the characters or I was seeing it. I was just experiencing it. And of course, I was writing about places where, you know, in 2008, I was in these places and I was doing very similar things. And I say I was just merging them in with these characters and making decisions, as John Pierce making decisions and, you know, almost like gaming it. You know, I've played a few war games and bits and pieces over the years, you know, almost like red teaming it, you know, you throw a problem in. But I already had an outline, so I knew where we were going. But it was always, the goal was actually a what if that was proposed to me at the time in 2010. And that was the end game, was this fictionalized what if. Imagine if it had actually happened and throwing a whole lot of issues at the guys. So, yeah, I live inside it. I mean, but of course, what that means is that when I'm writing, it's not that I have to write perfectly, but I have a very clean first draft because it needs to be right. Not each word, but it needs to be right in order for me to be enjoying the story, to have that foundation to then move forward from. So I tend to be quite slow and steady, and just sort of, like I say, just, it's like spending a year inside a book, but inside the story.
Right.
And that's how it works for me anyway. I speak it out loud and I'll have the conversation. I mean, the dialogue between characters is quite easy because that's exactly, it might not be exactly the dialogue I've had, but it would be it's exactly the dialogue I would have experienced or similar to in those kind of situations over the years. So I found that relatively straightforward and enjoyable. Some of the characters are loosely inspired by genuine people that were there at the time. I've changed nationalities, or I've you know, I've made them different enough so I wasn't constrained by the real person. But like I say, that gave it the foundation to really write from. It gave it that route, that pathway. So I never deviated too far away from it. You know, some of the anecdotal type stories that are thrown in, they give it that feeling of realism. I'm looking at things and I'm thinking, well, yeah, that sort of happened, but it happened to somebody else, you know, a year later, or it happened a year before in a totally different environment. But because in this, that realism, when you put in those characters, and so I didn't have to think up too many things. I just threw in something, all right, that really happened. But now imagine it happening to these characters. So it was really good fun. I mean, I really, really enjoyed writing this one.
You mustn't outline then. Do you kind of, like, when you sat down to do this book too, did you kind of know where it was going to end? Do you kind of know that ahead of time?
Yeah, I mean, I did outline this, but with this framework. So I knew where it was going, but in quite loose. I mean, you're talking about. I mean, some people write 20,000, 30,000 word outlines, these kind of things. I had a couple of A4 pages with notes on. Bullet points, so I know where it's going, and that's getting adjusted all the time, and I left it quite open, you know, a bit like red teaming, war gaming it, you know, right, if this happens, right, well, unfortunately somebody's going down, you know, this kind of thing, you know, and I was quite having spent so much time sort of almost feeling like you're part of the team, and that's what I wanted people to read, to feel like as though they, you know, they'd had the passport stamped and they'd been in and out of Guinea and riding with the team, you know, and experiencing these things. And, you know, if you feel something for the characters, then of course it makes any tension, any risk, any threat, and certainly any serious incidents that much more tangible, that much more emotional for anybody that's reading. And I felt that the same when I was writing it, even though these weren't real people. I probably felt more emotional writing the second book with the fictional characters than I did in the first book, which was just, you know, doing things from memory.
Well, that's because real people are awful.
That's right.
You know, fictional people are easier to like. You know, it's like a pet, you know, much easier.
Yeah.
Do you write from John Pierce's point of view then?
I do. That's having written these two books, that's, of course, that becomes a constraint in itself, with the first book being so closely aligned to things that happened to me. I mean, I say it isn't me, it's John Pierce. It is somebody different. But having used that and having used the sort of family setup, which was very similar to my own, because that influenced so much of the decision-making at the time. So again, it was difficult to separate it off. It does mean that it constrains sort of ideas for a third book, where I've been considering whether to write another John Pierce book, or whether to write a completely different set of characters and standalone, with serious potential, of course, as they always say. And I'm just, you know, looking at that at the moment. There was something that was proposed to me in early 2020 that I'm thinking of writing a what if sort of punchy thriller about, but I'm not quite sure how to approach that at the moment.
Don't make it. It was all a dream. You know, get politically correct. John Pierce is coming back. Yeah. He's going to transition into Janice or something. And then he's going to go back and do it again, but under a different identity. Come on.
Yeah. I mean, it's, to be honest, in the last few days, I've had two ideas. There was a third book that I was always going to write, because I spent 2011 and 12, I spent a couple of years on the counter-piracy stuff in the Indian Ocean off the Somali coast. I say off the Somali coast, I mean, Indian Ocean can be a long way off the Somali coast, depends where you're going, but, you know, bouncing around between Sri Lanka and Oman and Egypt and South Africa, you know, protecting the bulkers and the tankers from pirates. And I was going to, I still intend to write a book about that. And that was going to be a sort of third John Pierce book, but I'm now wondering whether to roll that out and do something slightly different, because it needs to be third person, multi-viewpoint, you know, I need to hit it a completely different way. And when you look at books like, you look at how books like Red Metal, Mark Graney and Rip Rawlings, Excellent book. You know, where you see almost like an old style, almost like Red Storm Rising style books, where you're seeing these multiple points of view, you know, of a big international thriller where incidents occur. And of course, with that, that's war. But I had quite a big sort of idea, and so I'm looking at various ways of approaching it. But I haven't. I'm not a full-time writer at all, and I'm a convenience writer. I write when I feel like it. I'm a bit more of like a Hank Moody in Californication type of writer. I write when I get. He's my inspiration. I write when I really feel like writing, rather than sitting to any big schedule. But of course, once you get in the story, you want to, you know, you actually want to write. You know, you want to get down there, and you want to sit down. But to be honest, even on a daily basis, I'm happy if the stories move forward, even if it's moved forward because I've thought of something new rather than how many words I've written. I mean, a lot of people write 1,000 words a day, 2,000 words a day, they do. And then they say they write 5 days a week, and you think, well, every year you're writing hundreds and hundreds of thousands of words. So, you know, and it works for them. But for me, I'm a lot fewer words. But when I do get them down, like I say, I try to make sure they're the right, or as closer to the right ones, or certainly the right story, as possible.
It's more important that way anyway, than just have a volume. Now your character, so have you developed him enough that people know who he is by these two books, do you think?
I think the second book, I mean, I just had a blog tour for the last couple of weeks, and I've been, you know, I really didn't know what the reception would be like. Because it's a long book, obviously it's a thriller in first person, and actually and a lot of it does feel has quite a third person feel to it, because I've used communications to be able to provide beyond visual range sort of ability to understand what's going on, to paint a bigger picture. But one of the things that has really come out is, even though I don't describe characters, I hardly ever actually give physical descriptions, is the bloggers that have reviewed the book tell it, saying how well developed and how they could literally, I mean, one of the, you know, saying they could, as though they could see him in front of them, you know, as though he stood right there, kind of thing. So, and as far as actually developing the character and his persona and everything, I mean, again, this is something that these initial reviews are all really singing about, you know, and the same with descriptions. I had with an early critique of Appetite for Risk. I was told, well, you need to, you know, you need to just up the description level a little bit, because you might have driven down a, you know, a dusty road heading towards Battle, but none of these readers have, you know. And this was a guy saying to me, it's an, you need to just put a little bit more in. And I don't do much in the way of descriptive writing, as in flowery descriptive writing, but it's one of those things that the first book, you know, the people were talking about how the visceral sort of nature. I mean, I had somebody talking about the second book saying it was like being in virtual reality. You know, that sort of what I went for, you know, that's what I was trying to do, was sit people down in an unusual situation and actually sort of experience, not just in the second book, not just with John Pierce, but with the whole gang, with the crew, with the team. It's a much wider cast, really, of important characters in the second book.
How do you decide who you're going to kill off? Do you take a person that you've met that you don't like, and then decide, well, listen, this is going to be the guy that dies?
No. What happened with this one was, I actually had earmarked some people for the Grim Reaper that managed to survive it. and that was just, and again, that was almost like, as though, you know, running an exercise. I mean, it, you know, like, almost like wargaming it. And oh dear, he didn't, you know, he survived it and he didn't, kind of thing. And that's what I went with. I didn't rethink it. I didn't, in fact, even with the editing, the reason why it took me quite a long time to finish the book, I'd finished the first draft within a year, but it took me another year to do the editing, was because when I edited, I was going through, giving a careful read through and making notes and then editing. And then I would leave it for 3 months and not even look at it again, because I didn't want to overread the book. I didn't want to analyze too hard the change. I didn't want to suck out the sort of the initial sort of energy of it, if you like, So I then do another big edit, you know, and then 3 months later I was picking up, and there wasn't any kind of preordained technique. It was just the way it worked. And it means that even now I'm not sick of the book. I read it, the paperback, when I got mine delivered, and I sat down and read it mainly because I wanted to check there wasn't a typo on page one. Because that's the one thing you always want, you know. And it's the one thing I always used to say. In fact, a guy I bumped into on the road in Suleiman in a cafe at Dukan, and he said, "Oh, Mr. John, the one thing you always told me," because he'd been promoted. He said, "is don't screw up on the first day," because of course, especially when you're running convoys or PSD tasks or anything else, anything could go wrong on any mission. And so my mantra was always, "Do not screw it up today. Just don't do it on the first day, because that's the day the client will always remember." You know, you mark your card with it. And so yeah, I did the same with the book. You're sort of reading through and thinking, let's get through the first chapter. Then let's get through part one. Right, let's get through part two. You know, just hoping that you're not going to see that terrible blooper. Unfortunately, there's one thing, but it's not actually a mistake. It was a proofreading change that was made that I didn't pick up, that I got changed then for the Kindle. But I also make sure both my books now I have one use of the Americanized verb behoove in and that's my friend Greg, who's a former Green Beret. I worked for his company out in Baghdad. He was always behooving. It would behoove us. We were always behooving a lot of things. So I stuck one in. In fact, the character Greg in the first book is actually is a description of Greg, Greg Holmes, who I know. And I've decided every book I ever write will always have one use of the verb behoove. And of course, the proofreader in the first book tried to change it to some British behove or something.
Yeah.
So I have to look at the first thing I do when I get a proofreading back is check and see if they've changed my behoove.
Yeah, just to put a little note at the beginning. Do not change.
I did. For this one, I did. I said there is a single use of the verb behoove, and it is intentional. Leave it alone.
When you're writing, you just go play it by ear. You don't sit down and clear time and do it and all that. You are just going by how you feel.
Well, to be honest, I mean, sort of. What was happening with a lot of when I was finishing off Don't Play Dead with Vultures, it was I'd actually shifted positions in the house. So I don't work in my office because I still work with the Middle East. Then I tend to do work early on, from early in the morning, and then by the afternoon, once everything's cleared, that's when I'll sit down and aim to sort of just as it begins to fall asleep, you know, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, start to write, and then write till sort of six. That would be, you know, and I got into quite a pattern of that. But funnily enough, when I'm overseas, I tend to write in the mornings because no one's up, because they're all late up, so I tend to get up early and write on a rickety kitchen table somewhere. But wow. But I do tend to get into a rhythm. It's just that you know, a lot of writers are writers. I mean, they're like proper writers. I mean, they're, you know, it's their calling, and that's what they do, which means they need to write every day. And they, you know, that's and that, absolutely, you know, that that's how I am when I'm in a book. But if I'm not writing a book, I mean, I'm still, you know, I didn't start writing until I was 49 for Appetite for Risk. And so I still have the belief that if you're writing something down, then it means you're working. I don't really think, you know, I wouldn't say I even enjoy writing. I just have some stories that are good fun, you know, effectively writing the books you want to read. And the other thing is, when I write, I read more. I'm a voracious reader, even more when I'm writing a book. I know a lot of authors don't like to read when they're writing. I read so much. It inspires me to be reading good books. It inspires me to be writing more.
And you read the same type of genre you're reading in?
Like, yeah. I read anything. But I mean, I tend to, you know, I do tend to read similar books. I mean, a lot of spy fiction, but I mean, psychological thrillers and military thrillers. I mean, yeah, sort of Don Bentley, Jack Carr, Rip Rawlings, Mark Greene, you know, to Charles Cummings, John le Carré, all the, you know, just whatever. I mean, Paul Vidic, sort of everything. I just read as much as I can. I mean, I've always got a paperback and an audio book and a Kindle book on the go all the time anyway. but even more so when I'm writing. I just find that I have to clear my mind of the book, almost the actual words on the page, and just read something else, because you've got it going through your head so many other times, walking the dog or training in the gym or anything else. The book's always there. So it's good to get those chances to fill your head with something else. And especially, you know, and appreciate other great stories. You know, there's nothing better than a book that you absolutely love that you just can't wait to get back into. You know, and I think it's, you know, you can go through a few books that are good books and you read them and they're great. And then you get one and you think, this is why I love reading. And this year, in January, I read two fantastic books. There was Bomber by Len Dayton, which is a 24 hours of a fictional bombing raid by the RAF over Germany. But it's not just it's from both sides. It's from the side on the ground in England, in Germany, and in the bomber crews. And an even better book that I read straight after that was Stephen Pressfield's The Afghan Campaign. I thought that was absolutely fantastic. It's absolutely what I would not expect to like. It's ancient, which I just would say I don't read. It's first person present tense. I mean, it just sounds, you know, it's a non-starter. And it's about a soldier in Alexander's army. And it's fantastic. It's an epic story. And I absolutely loved it. It's one of my top 10 books. I thought it was fantastic. And in fact, Stephen Pressfield's book, Killing Rommel, which was set in the Second World War, about an SAS patrol targeting Rommel, was also another fantastic book. So, I hadn't read any of his before, those two. And they are two brilliant books. But yeah, I mean, this, you know, it only inspires you even more when you read something that's fantastic. You know, everybody's looking that whenever you pick up a book, you're hoping this is going to be the one that's just going to, you know, you're just going to devour.
Now, do you have yourself set up on a website, and do you have like social media things? Do you like to interact with readers? Where can they find you?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a website that's now probably slightly out of date because obviously the second book's come out. I mean, there is bits and pieces on it, but it's slowly being updated. And that's at jacklevers.com. I am on Twitter. I do a bit of Facebook, but it's not my natural sort of habitat. And I, God knows what I do on Instagram, because I haven't got a clue what half of that stuff is. I mean, right, I get these posts and then it says, do you want to post this to your story? So I just click yes, and I've got no idea what's going on.
See what happens.
But I do have I'm at Jack Levers on Twitter, and in Facebook, I think it's at Jack Levers Author. But I mean, yeah, so I am around, you know, I'm around and about, and readers can get in touch. I had a couple of guys actually acknowledged in the book. One of them was for this is the second book in WW Vultures, and one of them was a Canadian pilot who I'm hoping I haven't screwed up when he reads the section that he advised me on. I mean, literally, of course, they give you all this advice and technical and everything else, and we chat about it, and of course it turns into about, you know, five lines or two lines in a paragraph in the book. And the same thing for a master sniper that I know. You know, all his advice and all the discussions we had, and I think the actual technical specifics is literally the name of the weapon, and that's probably about all that was included, although the usage was something separately. So I'm actually quite scared now, because they're both reading the book, I think, at the moment. So I'm waiting for the abuse to start flying. And also from any readers in Australia, because there's an important Australian character. So I'm sure I'm going to get some sledging from them for my awful Aussie slang. Although I'll be blaming the Aussies that I used to work with, because that's who I picked that all up from.
Oh, well, I'd be fine. Just watch out for that sniper. The sniper. You know,
that's right.
That's the danger. Well, this is interesting. We'll have all that up on the website as well. People can find you then, hunt you down. You know, writing over these situations, you're writing out and you're in these countries and you're all doing all these things. And I just wonder if how, you know, tension affects you. Does it sort of, when you get stressed or upset, does it sort of work against you when you write?
Yeah, it does. But I think the biggest, for all the things that happen physically and the difficulties you have, you know, people used to talk to me about Baghdad, about going down Route Irish, these kind of things. And I, you know, I wasn't PSD running down Irish at the worst of the times or anything. I'm not, you know, but what I used to say to them is, yeah, we might be traveling around, you know, Baghdad, and it's a relatively high threat. However, we're wearing body armor, we're in B6 armored vehicles, we're tooled up to the nines, we're equipped for it. You're actually, you know, the actual threat, you know, and the risk to yourself, your vulnerability is far higher when you're downtown at 2 o'clock in the morning in any major city on your own, stumbling around after having a few beers or heading home. You're vulnerable then. And there's a lot of places in South America and in Africa, you know, in Europe, everywhere where the vulnerability is heavy. But those kind of things you can cope with. I can cope with. The difficulty, I think, the hardest thing is actually financial stress and pressures. And I found in 2004, and about around the time when I, which I was in the book set, I was under massive sort of financial pressure. And that was scary. That really was scary until it's so bad that you realize that there's no choice. You can't go back to a normal job anymore. You know, you're so deep in that basically you've got a twist, you know, and you've got to go for it. And that's sort of what happened to me in 2004. And it still happens to me now. And actually it's the financial side of things. It's that that desire to get secure. And unfortunately, I, you know, my biggest fault is I'm a high, not gambler as in on the horses or the cards, but I take risks, business risks, financial risks. Okay, they're physical risks, but I go all in with these high risk, high reward situations where you end up on a precipice, and that pressure is the only is the hardest pressure. And of course, a lot of the way I look at it is that I have a potential big win on the other side, whereas there's a lot of people, especially now with the economic downturn that's affecting certainly UK, I'm sure the US is the same, where people, you know, they're without hope really of how they're going to get out of the situation. So a lot of the time I'm just grateful for what I've got, and that I might be, you know, standing on the precipice looking down, but you know, I've got a good chance that I'm going to make it over the other side and come up smelling the roses. And so far, it's always happened. Somehow, I've always pulled out of the bag. The next contract has come along, or you've got the win on something. But that kind of pressure, I think, is worse than anything that you get in the, you know, for me anyway, in the military or in the private sort of security sector. But then, I haven't been stuck in a firebase out in Afghan, you know, for six months. And I'm sure the pressure for the guys, you know, friends of mine that were out there in those situations, I didn't have that. You know, I've obviously served in other situations, but it's much more transitory when you're in private security, or for me it was mobile operations. You're running PSD, you're running convoys, you're in, out, you know, you've got a plan. You can say, yep, success, done that. You know, when you're launching patrols out of a firebase, you know, in some IED-ridden valley, for 6 months, that pressure's got to be absolutely horrendous. And of course, it. You know, but yeah, I think the financial side is the one thing that will keep me awake at night and make it difficult for me. But then, and then until it turns into anger, and then I start writing another book.
Anger
and frustration, because most of the time it's because I haven't been paid by somebody. Usually somebody in some far flung corner of the world where I then have to go and hunt them down and try to get my money.
No, shoot them. Come on. You know, and it's not like you're the pressure of waiting in the Starbucks drive through and being late for work. Now that is pressure. Jeez. Well, anyway, it's certainly interesting. So everyone, our guest today has been Jack Leavers, and we've been talking about his two books. Of course, the new one is Don't Play Dead with Vultures. If you've got to go, go hard. And of course, we got to keep him out of financial trouble. So everyone, get out there and buy a book. You know, keep him going. He doesn't have to go out and hunt down people anymore. So Mr. Jack Leavers, thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you very much, Alan. It's been great.
Thanks, Jack.
Yep, thanks, David.
Tired of wasting time trying to decide what to watch on your streaming service? Go to our website and look for the Martino Movie Reviews.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations?
Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.